This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is John Etherton. John is the president of Etherton & Associates and a frequent guest on the show, talk about all things legislative and just procurement in general. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Roger.
Well, it's, and John, it's that time of year again. We're back and we're talking a little legislation, the NDAA up on the Hill. And, you know, I guess I'll open it up to you and you can let the listeners know what you see as some of the, you know, interesting provisions.
Okay. I'm going to focus mostly on the acquisition policy areas. I think that the just to sort of set this in context in terms of process, the House Armed Services Committee reported their bill out. It's gone to the House floor. It was passed on the 14th of this month. And the Senate reported their bill about the same time. So we have now both the House passed bill with all the amendments on the floor, as well as the version coming out of the committee in the Senate. I don't know where the Senate, where they go with it. If it could come up in July. It may not come up until later. That's been the tradition in the last couple of years, but we'll see. So we now have a pretty good idea of what the issues are. And to put this in context, while there's a lot of discussion about many things in Congress that won't pass this year, I think that the defense authorization bill will be passed before the end of the year. And so it is meaningful to talk about these things because at some point, whatever survives the conference will become law and then will be implemented in regulation. A couple things I would start out by saying just generally about the two bills. One is I think that the scope of issues that we see this year is much smaller than last year. There was a lot of discussion last year about small business. We had a whole title of the House bill devoted to that. Much of that survived the conference. A number of issues in Title VIII in both the House and Senate bills on commercial pricing, contractor compensation, a number of other areas that were fairly significant. This year, it's a much more limited, a narrower scope of issues, but there are some interesting things.
Well, first, just why is that? Is it just folks want to mess less with the procurement system?
I think there are a couple things. Number one, you've had subcommittee chairmanships that have kind of switched around on both the House and Senate Armed Services Committees. And so there's always a time period after that where the members need to sort of get grounded in some of these issues. They had a very accelerated process this year because they didn't get the budget request until very, very late, essentially cutting off a month or 2 months off the process. That period is normally used for folks to sort of get a sense of what the agenda is, to do oversight hearings, and really to develop some things at length in a public record. And they didn't have that time this year. So they basically had to run right after they got the budget request to immediately go to markup to try to stay relevant. And so it really didn't leave a lot of time to really explore a lot of these issues. And then, of course, there have been the staff changes as well below that. So I think that it's just a matter of people getting their feet on the ground and sort of figuring out what agenda they want to develop. And I predict, and we can see if this happens or not, that next year we'll probably see more issues and sort of a broader agenda than what we're seeing this year. So that I think is the main issue. So we have a few things, I think, to look at. Contractor compensation is a big issue. It's addressed in both bills this year. There is, in fact, the rule that came out, I believe it was yesterday, both an interim and proposed rule implementing the language from the FY12 NDAA, expanding the current cap on the reimbursement of contractor compensation costs government-wide and also to all compensation costs for all employees, not just the
John, can you explain a little bit how that works?
Well, basically, we've had a provision in place. It's been modified in different ways since the 1998 authorization bill, which capped the executive compensation cost reimbursement for the top five at both the corporate level and the individual division level. That number was based on, in law, on the it is based on a formula that was used the compensation reported to the SEC for the senior executives for companies with more than $50 million a year in annual revenue. Unfortunately, for folks on the Hill, I guess, and they look at that, and what they see is that the numbers have increased much higher than the rate of inflation. I think if you go back and look at the formula and the results of that formula since 2004, it's increased at about an annual rate of about 8.5%, I think is what CBO had calculated, which is much higher than inflation. And I think people were concerned, especially now that we're applying this across all contractor compensation, that the number was too high. The administration has weighed in on it as well. And so there's now sort of looking for a new formula and a new approaches on this. In the House bill, what essentially they would do is freeze the formula at the current level, which is $763,209,000. And then from there on, every year it would be escalated by the Bureau of Labor Statistics Employment Cost Index for all private sector workers. But in the midst of that, they also would make unallowable the top five in the overall corporation, their compensation costs entirely, which could be up to a $3.8 million increase in unallowable costs. The Senate has taken a different approach in committee. They have basically, they took the number that was in place in the FY98 bill and then went back and escalated it for inflation. Instead of getting to the current 763, they got to 487. And that is the number that's the baseline number that they would put in place. Then they would escalate starting every year after FY14 using the same index that the House would do. And there's no exclusion of anybody for unallowables at the top five or anything. It would cover everybody. And I don't know where that goes. We may get to the floor. I know that Senator Manchin, for example, last week was successful in getting added to the immigration bill a cap of a permanent cap at the vice president's salary level, which is $230,700. With no inflation, no escalation after that. And he won the vote on the floor 72-26. I'm expecting that there will probably be some discussion when the Senate bill authorization bill gets to the floor on that. But that'll be a big issue, I think. Sort of.
So you got three numbers there, the 700,000 number, right. The 400,000 number, and then 250.
230. And well, there's okay. Actually, yes, and you got the 487, which is in the current Senate bill. And there was a vote in committee on the 487 versus the 230, and they opted to vote for the 487. So don't know how that the politics of that will all play out, and it's really, in my opinion, more a political issue than anything else.
But I wanted to ask just from a public policy perspective, why right. Is it important or not, or is it?
Yes. It's important because, in my view, the industry does not have sort of the ability to just set whatever salary and compensation levels they want. They have to be sort of they have to meet a standard of reasonableness, even if there is a cap or whether there's not a cap. And that reasonableness standard is normally based on surveys of similar positions throughout the private sector, you know, and what they pay in some range around the median.
And that's who they compete with
people, right? They're not competing among themselves in the defense industry as much as they're competing in the entire private sector. And so the government can do whatever it wants as far as this cap business is concerned, but that doesn't change that basic fact. And so over time, if the industry, which is a private industry that you want to have in some ways a competitive in the ability to offer very highly technical products, technologies, or whatever, and the ability to manage complex programs over many years, you want to have some pretty good people in charge of that at all levels. And if what you do is tie the industry's hands in terms of their ability to recruit by saying that we are no longer going to reimburse you for the legitimate costs of performing on these contracts, which is essentially what these caps do, then you're basically saying, you know, number one, we're not interested in necessarily the maintaining the quality over time of the people, that competitiveness, but also sending a signal to the industry that this, as a government,
it's not a priority.
And we're a special customer. In other words, all your other customers, once we agree on what the price is and the reasonableness of that, we will pay the cost of performing a contract. And in the defense side and the federal government side now, because this would be government-wide, we're basically saying that we're no longer willing to pay reasonable costs for you to perform a contract for us. And I think that is a very, very significant dangerous signal to send if you're trying to attract people into the government marketplace. So I think there's the bigger issues here. And I think, obviously, the higher the number is at the end of the day, the less that becomes an issue. But we're also seeing it in other areas as well.
Right. And to me, I tie it to like low price, technically acceptable, right. in terms of a philosophical approach to, you know, supporting government mission. Right.
Right. Exactly. And again, whatever you end up doing, whatever the level ends up being, you're not necessarily going to see a change overnight. And people argue, well, you know, the companies can pay these people whatever they want. While technically that's true, if you look at margins on government contracts versus the private sector generally, you're seeing
they're lower.
They're much lower. Yeah, and the idea that there's headroom in there to simply divert money to something that prior to this was an allowable cost is I think, somewhat naive. That's a problem.
Right. And it seems to me you want your best and brightest management team, right, you know, building cybersecurity solutions, right, for example, to protect the homeland. John, we do have to take a break right now, but when we come back, we'll be talking more to John Etherton of Etherton and Associates, and we'll continue our discussion of the National Defense Authorization Act provisions that are out there currently, as well start looking at some overall trends in government contracts. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
This is an important time for the federal government, a chance for agencies to do things differently. How will you help shape your future? Turn to Deloitte. With our private sector insight and public sector experience, we'll help you rethink, reduce, and restructure, and turn resolve into results, so you can see what's possible and make it happen. See how at Deloitte.com/federal. Wherever you need to go, Deloitte sees you there.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton of Etherton Associates. And John, when we took the break, we had just finished a little discussion of one aspect of the NDAAs that are out there, and that's the employee compensation caps. What are some other areas that would be of interest to our listeners?
Well, I think a couple things that are worthy of note, starting with the House bill. If you look at the House report, they actually have some pretty, I guess, strong admonitions for the Department of Defense with respect to the whole lowest price technically acceptable and the increase in those kinds of acquisitions. I think there's a GAO report requirement out of that as well. And there's other words also in the Senate report, which also raise some concern about that. And I think that is significant. I think that there are a couple of floor amendments that came up on the House bill that also are worthy of further attention. One is the Federal Information Technology Acquisition Reform Act that came out of the Oversight and Government Reform Committee, Chairman Issa's bill, which really tries to restructure within the agencies, and that's civilian agencies only in this case, the role of the CIO, especially in the enterprise-wide IT space. And some people have characterized this as sort of a return to maybe a Brooks Act concept and oversight of these acquisitions. And whether that's the appropriate way we should be moving forward or not, but I think it's now in the bill, and there'll be a lot of discussion about that over the course of the summer.
Now, FITERA, that, you know, as it's written and put in the NDA, applies only to the civilian agencies?
That's correct. That's right. The way it works out, yeah, in terms of the CIO roles are already defined in Title 10 for DOD, and I think that the real issue, the real focus, and where they were sort of advised to go was to focus more on the civilian agencies, which is more their committee's jurisdiction.
Now, does that end up being, you know, not to be all technical, up being germane to the NDAA?
Well, it's in it. Yeah. You know, if the House votes and puts it in, it's in. It's similarly right on the Senate floor. If
right,
you get 100 senators to support it, anything's germane, right, I guess. So I think it makes it an interesting political issue, though, for conference as to how the Senate will engage with that. Because in the Senate, again, not to get too technical, but the House, you'll often have outside conferees. If there's a provision that affects other committees' jurisdiction other than armed services, they'll be designated as special conferees for those portions of the bill. The Senate does not follow that rule, so the only conferees in the Senate will be the Armed Services Committee members.
Sure. And I have another question about that.
Sure.
So, you know, FITERA talks a lot about a reorganization of government functions, whether it's procurement and the CIO as well. Does that need to be, you know, you're my expert.
Right.
Does that need to be scored, how much it would cost?
If it was not scored on the floor, doesn't need to be scored. I looked at the bill, and my reading of it was, and again, I'm no CBO person or an expert
sure
in scoring, and there is a little bit of an art to that, but I did not see anything in there that jumped out at me as a scorable provision.
Okay.
I'm sure that their CBO reviewed it before they adopted it on the floor. I'm sure that there will be further looks at that as they go through the conference, but it certainly isn't the case that the entire bill or the entire amendment was scorable, but I didn't see anything in there that jumped out at me.
Okay. Other provisions?
The other one I just want to mention is an interesting provision that was added on small business. We've had discussions over probably the last 20 years on how to effectively count small business participation in the subcontractor base that support prime contracts. And frankly, nobody was able to come up with a reasonable methodology that could garner broad support going beyond the first tier for companies to allow them to get credit for all their small business dollars. There was an amendment added on the Senate, and I don't have the section number yet because we don't have the bill as passed, but basically would amend the Small Business Act to do that very thing, to allow companies and agencies, as far as credit is concerned, to count all of the small business dollars in their subcontracts, not just the first tier. Now, there are some interesting and difficult methodological issues with that to avoid double counting and how you capture that, how you report it. And those things are going to have to be discussed over the summer.
Yeah, the flow down of those provisions.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think that this is a significant step in that conversation. And it's interesting to me from a political perspective that this was a time when it looks like the small business community, as well as the large business community, was generally on board with this, which has not been the case in the past. So I think that the prospects for something of that making it into the final bill are reasonably good. But that is a new issue that I think has been discussed and kind of got stuck in the wheel spinning in the mud for a long, long time. And now it looks like we're going to be moving forward on that conversation. So that's interesting.
So, John, let's circle back. Just the first one you mentioned, I think, was LPTA and the concerns. Can you talk a little bit about what concerns were expressed and what's the potential impact?
I think that the concerns, and again, it's more explicit in the House language than in the Senate language, is the idea that lowest price technical acceptable has a role, a legitimate role in acquisition for services, especially if you can clearly define what the service is and you can basically define most elements and things are relatively simple that you're buying. And there has been a general concern, and I've certainly heard a lot from my clients in industry, that in fact the default now has been more to go to LPTA because it's easier. It's easier to get to a contract award on that basis, and that the concern is that you're doing this with very complex services where things are not been defined, and you're just essentially kicking a lot of problems down the road.
Sure.
And not necessarily getting the best value from an award in that case. Now folks are up on the net talking about it. It was interesting that we recently got the Better Buying Power 2.0 in its final form. And Mr. Kendall came over from the department and talked to the industry at the CSIS meeting, I think it was in April. And probably LPTA got more questions at that meeting and more concern raised from the audience than any other issue. And so this is this is not legislation,
right?
But at least it's policy, it's report language. It sort of sets the stage, I think, for what may be oversight as we go down,
Right. And interesting in Better Buying 2.0, one of the things that sort of struck me is, there's language in there about, saying, hey, use LPTA when it's, as you said, it's a clear requirement, that sort of thing. And you've articulated requirements that ensure quality, you know. But at the same time, with regard to best value, it's got language in there saying, you need to articulate the additional, price or value of exceeding, the requirement or, exceeding threshold. And I just, thinking someone who's, I worked in procurement for 20 years, inside government, trying to figure out an exact number or some sort of value for exceeding a requirement and then putting that in the RFP, that's a pretty hard threshold in itself, and almost in a certain sense, Mead will drive people again towards the idea of doing LPTA. I don't know what you think of that. But.
Well, and I think that's the concern. You raise that bar so high, and you also faced, given the total chaos in the budget process, with the need to get money obligated and the need to do things, in people's minds, quote, as simply as possible. And so I think there's a lot of bias right now in the process toward kind of LPTA types outcomes. And that's why I think people are really getting concerned about it because, again, as people were talking at the CSIS event, everybody kept saying, look, this is going on in a widespread fashion now. What are you going to do about it? There was a lot of concern about it, a lot of energy around it. And that obviously has gotten to the Hill, and I think the folks up there are concerned as well.
Okay. So I think we've done enough, right? On NDAA. Yeah. So why don't we just turn to some, you know, we got a couple segments left and we're close to the end of this second segment, but sort of start to turn the conversation to some sort of big picture sort of trends and issues that we could talk about. And, you know, first, I think we want to talk about commercial item contracting or access to the commercial marketplace. And as you well know, because you were involved in a lot of it, you know, we spent the 90s trying to give greater access to commercial products and services, you know, commercial item contracting, you know, Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act, all those efforts to streamline the process and tap into the federal marketplace. And, you know, from your perspective, where are we now with that?
Well, there was a real push, obviously, and it was probably the main message that came out of the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act and the Clinger-Cohen bill that followed in 1996, that we wanted to open up the system not only to commercial items that were sort of brand name kind of things, but much more broadly to incorporate things that could come out of the commercial marketplace, where the commercial market was driving innovation, and one of the major areas everybody focused on was electronics. And if you look at the electronics content of everything, it just, you know, continues to go up.
Yes, absolutely. And your car, everything, right?
Everything. Yeah. It seems like everything. So the idea was that if we didn't figure out some way to be able to tap into that and make the system more open to those kinds of things and those technologies, that the government was going to be both in a position with obsolete things and unaffordable.
You know, and John, on that point, you know, we'll come back to that. Okay. But right now I have to tap into the commercial marketplace by doing, you know, by taking a break. But when we come back, we'll be talking more to John Etherton, president of Etherton Associates, and we'll continue our discussion of commercial item contracting where we are today. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
The mission of government involves critical efforts to improve national defense, economic security, health services, and citizens' lives. The strategy and technology consultants of Booz Allen Hamilton are proud to help government address cyber threats, reform the financial system, modernize infrastructure, and protect our nation. For nearly 100 years, Booz Allen has partnered with clients to deliver results that endure. To see Booz Allen's ideas in action, visit BoozAllen.com.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton of Etherton Associates. And John, when we took the break, you know, we had just started our conversation about you know, access to the commercial market and commercial item contracting. And you know, as just a reprise, you know, we did spend a lot of time and energy in the 90s trying to gain greater access to commercial innovation, frankly. And as you mentioned, electronics in particular is a great example. And you were about to talk about where we are today or what the status is and what you think's going on.
Well, just to go back, you know, and to summarize, I think if you look back in the, there were a lot of things in the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act and Clinger-Cohen, but I think the idea, one of the main ideas on commercial items and services was that you would have a very broad definition of commercial items and commercial services, which would allow you to, you know, sort of get the whole realm of things that might be out there that the government could take advantage of, and streamline tools for that in FAR Part 12 and all the things that we're working with. And I think the experience that since then has been that it has been a challenge for the Department of Defense and the other federal agencies to take full advantage of that and to manage contracting in that space, you know, effectively, because of the different ways that the government buys things, even without all the special rules and things, the different ways the government funds things and budgets for things, and the timeframes, where the government may have a technology that they'll keep for a much longer period than in the commercial side. You'll throw it away after 2 years. You get into the issues of how do you support that, how do you diminish your manufacturing sources and obsolete kinds of things and all that. And I think there's been a lot of frustrations with it. I think obviously on the pricing side, people have had a lot of concerns with that broad definition on how you do that. And so now we're at a position where I think, frankly, there's not most of the lip service and the interest seems to be on the other side of this. We're getting proposals coming out of the administration to limit the ability to buy commercial items under using FAR Part 12. Last year, we had the language that basically would attempt to limit the definition and eliminate of a type and offer for sale from the definition of commercial items, which the Hill did not go along with. This year, there was language on subpoena power for DCA and others to look for pricing information that was primarily, in my view, aimed at commercial items, if you do the read up. There isn't a lot of focus right now on sort of rejuvenating that market, or how do we make it more friendly, or things like that. Either people feel that it's already been done, or that they're so concerned about these other cases, and it's the small number of cases, really, if you look at it, where people feel like there have been abuses and they want to try to tighten it up. And I think, frankly, we're going to have to change that mindset a little bit, because we are now entering, and we're in the middle of, a major downturn in government spending, major downturn in DoD spending, where the ability to tap into commercial solutions, whether they're developed solely for the commercial marketplace or developed for the marketplace and the commercial side and modified for government purposes, is going to be more critical than ever. And all the signals and signs we're getting is that the market right now is not very friendly to buying things with a FAR Part 12 process. We had a case a couple months ago where the Army was trying to buy I forget what the commodity was. It was some kind of thing that had been modified for their use. It was commercial technology. And they basically put in the solicitation words that essentially said, if you can't come forward with demonstrated sales in the commercial marketplace for this very item, then we're not going to consider it as a FAR Part 12 item, period, and of a type and offered for sale. And this is an item that had been bought many times before. There was a protest. The Army withdrew the solicitation and amended it to comply with the FAR. But the problem that I keep hearing about, you know, individual cases where sort of operationally people are requiring that a more narrow definition of commercial item be followed, even for items with commercial technology that have been purchased for many years. And it's all around the pricing issue and things, and I understand that. But again, I think there's a lot of techniques and things that could be explored there, short of, you know, essentially shutting down major parts of the FAR Part 12 process to different products and technologies.
Yeah, it seems to me it's almost, well, for example, the Better Buying Power initiatives, I've been reading through them again just recently, and commercial item or access to commercial marketplace, that sort of philosophical view, or just even Part 12 commercial item contracting and taking advantage, it's not mentioned anywhere in any documents.
Right.
So, and it seems to me one of the things it is taking, which government tends to do is the extreme example and writing a rule to prevent the extreme example,
right,
which, basically limits the flexibility of anybody to actually take advantage of the flexibilities that were intended with commercial item contracting.
Well, and I think what we're basically sending a signal, and we're basically saying to the companies, if you want to sell in the commercial space, whether it's technology that is off the shelf and or it's technology that is modified, but it's basically commercial-based technology, which the company may be paid to develop, not the government. Notwithstanding that, you could still be subject, if some of these proposals pass, of having records subpoenaed, which is not a normal thing that happens when you're dealing with a customer. Your intellectual property may be at risk in terms of delivery under a contract, even if you're a subcontractor. And then we have these other special terms and conditions which may impact your ability to either protect your intellectual property, recover all of your costs, and things like that. That signal is not a good one, I think, for companies that have choices as to which marketplace they want to serve. And so I think we're going to need to have a real, because I keep seeing these piecemeal proposals coming out of the department to make these changes, and I think we're going to have a real, more comprehensive discussion about the future of commercial acquisition, because, again, it's going to be one of the major components of how the department's going to manage its budget cutbacks.
Well, John, it's fundamentally a strategic issue. Right? Because if you continue to go down the road where you're creating it much more and more difficult for traditionally commercial firms to provide commercial technology to the department, you're limiting your supplier base, right? You're closing your market to a limited number of companies who are basically engineered around, the government procurement system.
Right.
So in the long run, it seems to me what that leads to is lower quality and increased costs for the taxpayer.
Right.
So let's turn to parallel to that to me is and frankly, one of the things about that we were trying to do in the 90s, I think, was streamline the process, rely on the commercial marketplace to make it, make the job easier to a certain extent, I guess, for the acquisition workforce. Do you want to talk a little bit about bit about, you know, the acquisition workforce and what, you know, what you see there?
Well, I've got some real concerns. I mean, I think that Congress, starting around 2006, 2007, I mean, we when I was on the Hill and we have our oversight hearing every year on acquisition policy, the conclusion that everybody got at the end of the hearing was that the people are your most important thing and you really need to nurture the workforce. But we didn't really do much about it other than put new requirements on education and training and things like that. In terms of money, not much of it flowed into that area. Really have to commend the Armed Services Committees and the Congress as a whole in 2007, 2008, because they set up the Acquisition Workforce Development Fund for the Department of Defense, in which they actually took money and set a revolving fund up to specifically have additional money for recruiting, retention, and training and education. And I'm concerned because, you know, up until about 2012, anytime there was talk of a cutback or anything else, it was always, yes, we'll cut back. We need to, you know, maybe even shrink the size of the overall civilian workforce in DOD and everybody else for that matter. But the fact of the matter is that we need to protect the acquisition workforce and shield them from some of
this. Right,
sort
of like fence them off, right?
Fence them
that's
off.
The language
and you don't
used
hear
to
talk
hear.
Like that as much anymore. Last year, in the final version of the bill, there's a Section 955, which talks about making sort of commensurate cuts in the civilian workforce and the contractor workforce to match the force structure cuts that the military is undergoing through FY17. There were a number of exemptions to that, those cuts and the reductions, but one of the things missing from that list is the acquisition workforce. And so I think that, that's an issue. I mean, if you look at Better Buying Power 2.0, you look at the Weapons Systems Acquisition Reform Act of 2009, you look at some of the other requirements, these are all things which will require effectively people's time and attention to a much greater degree to effectively implement. And you have to have, A, the people, and you also have to have the ability to provide training and technical
But people have
resources.
To have the skills, right?
Right. They have to have the skills, and they also have to have the tools. Some of that is, you know, different IT and other kinds of things. So you have to be willing to invest in that to get successful outcomes in with some of these new initiatives. And people just aren't talking about it as much as a need right now. And I'm a little bit concerned about that. And hopefully we'll see more lifting up of the workforce
right, as
an area that really needs to be a focus, and especially in the downturn that we're in as far as funding.
Right. And because, I mean, that's an investment, you know, in that will the returns on that, you know, effectively functioning acquisition workforce in terms of, you know, awarding, you know, sound contracts
right.
and best value outcomes for the American people. I mean,
right.
that's a fundamental aspect of it. You know, John, we have to take our last break, but when we come back, we'll be talking more to John Etherton of Etherton and Associates, and we'll talk a little bit about, you know, process integrity, where we are with that, and how do you measure performance in the procurement process. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton. John is president of Etherton & Associates. And John, when we took the break, we were about to segue into process integrity, or process integrity in the procurement system. Can you talk about, first, what is that from your perspective?
Well, I think it's a concept and a philosophy which says if you design a very well, carefully thought out process, and you clarify what requirements are as you go from one stage of the process to the next, and who is responsible for implementing those, that in a sense you will be driving better outcomes. And I think, frankly, there is some evidence that in fact, is the case. I think the most recent GAO report on major systems acquisition pointed to lower unit costs, and even in cases where there weren't significant changes in quantity. So I think we are seeing some of the benefits of that. I sort of step back and look and say, okay, you know, very good, important type things, especially if you're doing things at the front end. But I also recognize that nothing in the process is a free good. They take people's time and attention, and you have to sort of balance out, you know, various aspects of the process in order to have things run with efficiency and serve your customers, the warfighters, and the other agency customers. I personally think that we've been focusing probably more attention on process integrity at the expense of other aspects of the process. I think that if you look at especially the chaotic budget process that we've been in for the last 3 or 4 years, it's going to be very hard to maintain that level of focus on process integrity at the expense of everything else. I think what you end up with is a situation where money doesn't get obligated fast enough, or it gets obligated too quickly at the end, and you don't get the outcomes you're looking for there. And there's some other issues that I think that come up with that. My feeling is that what we need to really be honest with ourselves about is that we have a certain amount of resources in terms of people and their tools that they have. You only have so much time and attention. And what you have to figure out is either are we going to make greater investments in the process in terms of more people, better tools or whatever to achieve the goals that we want on process integrity, or are we going to have to recognize that we have a certain set of assets and we're going to have to manage across a number of different issues. You want process integrity, you want timeliness, you want the ability to meet requirements effectively and that sort of thing, and whether in fact we're going to have to look at a sort of a balanced approach on that that maybe looks perhaps at a more streamlined process and something that or something that is maybe less costly.
Sure.
And we're not having that conversation yet, but I think we are going to have it.
Right. It's a question of balance in the system, right? And you know, one of the areas that I mean, I think oversight is part of process integrity and where we are with oversight. And I just give you my, when I think of process integrity run wild, so to speak, I think back to the old GSBC, General Services Board of Contract Appeals, and doing bid protest on information technology. That oversight function's so focused on process and whether the process was followed that there are organizations that were specifically built that, you know, their goal was to make sure they followed the process, and the idea of, you know, what's the best value for the taxpayer sort of gets lost in that. And so I just wonder what you think about the role of oversight these days.
Well, I think it's important. And again, we can go back and find cases where it was inadequate. You can still see the number of GAO and IG reports where they're finding specific procurements where things were not done correctly. The question is layering a new process or new sort of one-size-fits-all approval across that the solution? I think it also tends to drive us into a measurement process which looks at things on a transaction-by-transaction basis, and we don't see the cost.
It's like a tactical level as opposed to strategic.
You don't see the cost and the price you pay more broadly by focusing, you know, at that level and really sort of toting up the costs and the benefits, you know, on an individual transaction. And I think we're going to have to find sort of a balance again with the cutbacks, with the people, with furloughs, with all these other things that we're dealing with, which effectively balances things and which allow things to flow through the process in a way that people have confidence that the money is being spent wisely. It's going to be a real challenge.
Right. And so with regard to oversight, let's talk about this other question of how do we measure, the performance of our acquisition system? That's one of the questions I always scratch my head when I look at the Better Buying Power Initiative. There's some statements, in the introduction to it in terms of potential savings or ability of trying to wring money out of the system to do more without more, or do more with less kind of, thoughts. How, can you measure the success? Or it goes back to process integrity. Back when I was, when I was doing IT procurements, a lot of the, success was measured on whether you got a protest or not, and whether you followed the process, not whether the actual stuff that was bought met mission requirements.
Well, I think there's a myth that somehow you can set up a process that means you don't have to measure, that if you design it so well, measurement is not necessary. The process will work itself. You don't have to measure.
Perhaps
outcomes.
That's what they think of Better Buying Power, too.
Well, it's a temptation. I mean, I think when we had the discussions in the mid-80s about increasing competition, I think it was the same idea that if you compete all these things, you don't have to measure. I mean, the competition by its very nature will drive you to the best outcomes. I think, frankly, when we did the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act, and the idea that we would tap into the commercial marketplace, that the market would set, various things, you wouldn't have to regulate it as much. And again, I think yes in some cases and no in other cases. There's no silver bullet. I mean, I believe, though, we're in a position now where we have the tools, we have the records, where we can actually start measuring outcomes based on using different strategies, whether in one conversation we had last year and the Better Buying Power 1.0 was the issue of fixed price versus cost type contracts for low rate initial production. And, yes. And you can see, well, in this case, we did it. In this case, we didn't do it. What was the outcome? And I think that Mr. Kendall, I recall him saying it was February a year ago, saying that there was no difference in outcome, that that really wasn't the factor which drove success or not. That's, to me, the more of those kinds of exercises where you really look at that would get us away from either trying to just say, well, we'll just add another layer, we'll add another requirement, and that'll fix the problem, to something where let's look at outcomes and based on the historical record, our ability to do analytics and other kinds of things and the tools we have now, that we can actually make these policy decisions based on a much deeper understanding and maybe come up with a system that has a better balance to it. And I hold out hope for that. But again, if you want to go in that direction, you have to make investments. It would be, for example, in my opinion, the root cause analysis office that looks at the program assessment root cause analysis, I think there's probably the core of the people that would do that effectively for some of those things.
So they have to make investments, right?
Make investments. And right now, it seems like that's where the department wants to go. They have put in Better Buying Power 2.0 this idea of doing a performance assessment, not only internally with the department, but also from an industry perspective, which I think is a terrific idea and really will get us into a much wiser policymaking posture in the future. But again, you have to make the investments in the tools and the people things to really make that successful. And hopefully we'll do that.
Right. Making those investments, you got to figure out the right way to do it, right? Because if you do it the wrong way, the stakes are so high, you do it the wrong way, you get bad data, right?
Right.
And so you're making decisions based on, faulty information.
Yeah. And you're never going to be in a state of perfect knowledge. But I think looking at things from that broader perspective is a more effective way of deciding future policy than trying to measure things on a transaction by transaction basis, where a lot of the costs and some of the benefits just aren't going to be evident no matter how you look at it.
Right.
I mean, you need to get to this higher level of looking at the process in order to really understand what's going on.
Right. All right, John, this isn't fair, John, but we've got a minute left. Sequestration budget, where are that could be the whole show, but I'll give you a minute.
There's no relief in sight, I think, on FY13 unless the effects of sequester are dire in a more national way, as I think this is what I said the last time I was here. I don't think there's going to be any movement in Congress to do anything about it. I think the real question is FY14. DOD is looking at a $52 billion hit from their present top line request. Congress has not addressed that in any of the authorization appropriations bills yet. I think the belief is that somehow down the road there will be some way to work a deal. We see where that's gotten us up to the present time. My personal feeling is when the debt ceiling debate occurs, if it does occur at the end of this year, I think a lot of those things will be talked about in conjunction with that, but that's about as much as I can say.
Yeah.
I think on all the agencies, I hate to say it, but I think everybody's going to be operating under a continuing resolution come the end of September.
Continuing resolutions have become permanent, haven't they?
Well, not exactly, but they become more extended.
Yes.
But I think I'm always looking for the light at the end of the tunnel. I don't know if I see any, but I think that there's a possibility that the debt ceiling discussion may force some decisions earlier in this cycle than last time, and maybe by the end of the year we could have a little clearer sense of the way forward. So we'll
Great. Thank you, John. I want to thank my guest, John Etherton of Etherton & Associates. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30 only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.